Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you so very much for tuning in tonight and every Wednesday night. And my thanks goes out tonight to the group Zingaya for their music that you were just listening to. That piece in particular is a snippet from their song Nomad's Land. Well, I wonder how many listeners attended a Lama celebration this past weekend. This holiday goes back to those simpler times when we were closer to the land, when we realized how much we depended on Gaia for all our needs, and we didn't just walk into the grocery store and everything was right there for us, when we were more agriculturally oriented and, I guess, less industrially oriented. Well, in paganism, Lammas is often called Lunasid, celebrating the first harvest and the reaping of the grain. It's considered a cross-quarter holiday and halfway between summer solstice, which some people call Litha, and the autumn equinox, Mebon. It's a pagan holiday that's sort of been co-opted by the Christians, like so much was, though some don't even realize it and some hate to admit it. In some English-speaking countries and in the Northern Hemisphere, August 1st is called Lammas Day, L-A-M-M-A-S, or Loafmas, M-A-S-S. That's always a clue right there when you see the M-A-S-S, that it's a celebration or holiday that has a Christian twist. It's the festival of the wheat harvest, and it's the first harvest festival of the year. On this day, it was customary in some places to bring to church a loaf made from the new crop. In many parts of England, tenants were bound to present freshly harvested wheat to their landlords on or before the first day of August. In the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, where it was referred to regularly, it's called the Feast of First Fruits. The blessing of new fruits was performed annually in both the Eastern and Western churches on the 1st or the 6th of August, the latter date being the Feast of the Transfiguration of Christ. Well, I happened to attend two Lammas celebrations this weekend. One was at a group that I belong to, women and men, called Willow Lodge. The other, given by the ICM of Isis Padusis, because I was the presiding hierophant at an ordination also held that day after the Lammas ritual. And I'd like to share with you some of the prayers for the earth we offered up for this holy day of Lammas. I'll read you the opening prayer. And it was followed by, the opening prayer was called a song of remembering. And it was followed by a second part called the song of healing. And then there was the third, the concluding prayer, called a song of celebration. And if you like these, you can actually go on the UN website, that's the United Nations website, and find it there, because this ritual is based on the UN Environmental Sabbath, or you can find it at earthministry.org. It was inspired by the earth healing work of Marco Paganic. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. Anyway, I think you will enjoy this, and it's our way of here at Voice of the Sacred Feminine of continuing to honor the earth this week, because we certainly, as a culture, as humans, we certainly don't do it enough. So as we're waiting for our first guest tonight to call in, I'm going to go ahead and share this Lamas prayer with you. In the first part, a song of remembering, and it goes like this. We have the privilege of seeing and understanding. We have the responsibility of caring and acting. We have the joy of celebrating. May the earth receive this gift of healing. And then the reader says, let us remember who we are. And the participants all answer, let us remember who we are. As we turn our attention to the unfolding of the cosmos, as we turn our attention to the cycles of life, as we turn our attention to the healing of the earth, let us remember who we are. Have we accumulated more than we need or want? Have we given away our intention and become confused? Have we accepted untruths? Let us remember who we are. Where we are greedy and the land becomes barren, where we are careless and the waters become unclean, where we forget our power, the air becomes polluted. Let us remember who we are. Who will die if the forests die? Who will disappear if the creatures disappear? Who will remain when we have forgotten the living earth? Let us remember who we are. Let us offer and accept forgiveness. Let us find and share the power to change. Let us offer and accept the gift of healing. Let us remember who we are. And then it goes into part two, called the Song of Healing. And again, it says, we have the privilege of seeing and understanding. We have the responsibility of caring and acting. We have the joy of celebrating. May the earth receive this gift of healing. And the reader says, we join with the earth and with each other. And the participants all respond in same. We join with the earth and with each other. To protect, honor, and heal the land. To walk upon the earth with eyes open. To take nourishment and return love and respect. We join with the earth and with each other. To protect, honor, and heal the great forests and all the plants. To use wisely the gifts they give us. To breathe deeply and remember the root in earth, the leaf reaching the sun. We join with the earth and with each other. To protect, honor, and heal the waters. To listen to the living songs of ocean, river, rain, fountain, and tap. To drink deeply and be purified. We join with the earth and with each other. To protect, honor, and heal earth's mantle of air. To glory in the shining sky. To call out the names of the holy ones and invoke their protection. We join with the earth and with each other. To protect, honor, and heal the soul of the earth. To live justly and in peace. To be a blessing to all that lives and all that supports life. We join with the earth and with each other. And then the final part, the song of celebration. We have the privilege of seeing and understanding. We have the responsibility of caring and acting. We have the joy of celebrating. May the earth receive this gift of healing. And the reader says, we rejoice in all life. And the participants respond, we rejoice in all life. We live in all things. All things live in us. Through life, joy comes to the earth. We rejoice in all life. As the worm turns the soil, as the spider spins the web, each to our work, joy comes to the earth. We rejoice in all life. As the grain feeds the hungry, as the vine brings song and sleep, having earned our harvests, joy comes to the earth. We rejoice in all life. As the bird cares for the nestlings, as understanding fills the home, nurturing the future, joy comes to the earth. We rejoice in all life. As every being lives in full integrity, as every word is spoken with truth, here and now, joy comes to the earth. We rejoice in all life. And the reader says, may the earth receive our intention for her healing, this Lammas. And the participants say, so mote it be. So as I said, you can go to www.earthministry.org, and you can find that that prayer there, an earth healing ritual. Well, I know most of you listen from the archives, but I want to remind you and invite you to call in and comment if you're listening live. The number is 718-766-4662. And tonight I have a doubleheader planned for you with two guests, but I'm beginning to get a little bit concerned because our first guest, Brenda McCoy, is not called in yet, and we spoke this morning, so I'm a little bit concerned about why she hasn't called yet. And if we do, in fact, get her on the line as well as our second guest later, we will not be having a What's the Buzz segment due to time constraints. So I'm hoping we still get Brenda here at the top of the hour for you because she is an Isis priestess. She's the author of Wings of Isis, which is her new book out this year. I know she certainly wants to talk about that. And besides talking to us about the new book, she was going to tell us about Isis, her life as a priestess, and her many trips to Egypt and the temples there and their importance. Then about 7 o'clock, we'll have for your pleasure Ruth Gould Goldman. She'll be calling in. She's the author of The Sacred Book of You, Unveiling the Lost Teachings of the Deep Feminine. And our topic will be healing our trauma, healing our world with the divine feminine. And if she happens to be listening, if our first guest doesn't call in, she, Ruth, is actually welcome to call in earlier. So what I think I'm going to do is take a minute and put some music on for you listeners while I get on the other phone and actually try to see if I can reach our guest, and maybe she's having some technical difficulties I can help her with. So I think I'm going to let you listen to a beautiful piece by Lane Redman called Invoking Aphrodite. So stay with me and enjoy the music, and as soon as I resolve this one way or another, I will be right back to you.
Smoking with incense, cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses, and from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze, and a soft wind gently breathes. Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your melissa to life.
Πατυχάρια με νάλσος μαλλίαν, όμοι δεν επιμιάμενοι
Hope you enjoyed that music by Lane Redman, and our guest has arrived on the line here, so we won't have much more of a delay getting into her interview. So Brenda, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. All right. Well, first let me say of Lady Brenda, she was one of my early mentors. She taught me to make my first sistrum, which is the sacred rattle and magical instrument of Isis, and actually Hathor and Bast as well. And we also traveled to Egypt together. She's a wonderful psychic. She also reads tea leaves, and she's a great card reader. And I can't think of a better person to speak about Isis or Egypt or having written a book about the temples in Egypt, which we're going to get to tonight. But let me sort of give you her official bio. Like most of us women in this day and age, she wears a lot of hats. Besides being a professional psychic and writer and priestess, she is an Egyptologist. She's a published author of nonfiction in the metaphysical genre. And as I said, her most recent book, Wings of Isis, published by O Books, is out just this year. And it presents a temple-by-temple guide to the magic and mystery of ancient Egypt. Previous publications of hers include The Way of the Witch, which is an audio series put out by Stone Harvest Studios, and Lady Brenda's Practical Magic. She's a screenwriter. She's completed three scripts and has her screenplays registered. They're called The Heart of Anubis, Red Bluff, and Double Act, all of which are in various stages of submission at the time. And she's also written for several magazines and newspapers, including the Channeltown Press, Entertainment Roundup, and Raven's Call. So, Brenda, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad to be here. And I apologize for showing up late, but that's kind of my shtick. What can I say?
Well, I've known you for a long time, and when you weren't here 5 minutes before the show, I said, well, you know what? Some things just never change. and then I started thinking, are we in Mercury retrograde? Time?
No. Okay. It must have to do with Mars being so close to the Earth. You know, it's the closest to the moon that it's been in like thousands of years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how does that affect us? Does it just sort of throw us off a bit or what?
It doesn't throw us off, but it's Martian energy. So, especially those people who are affected by Mars, ruled by Mars, like Aries, like my husband, things could get a little spun out of control. Impulsive act,
Impulsive acts. Remember, you told me he actually went and bought the beautiful house that you live in. He went and bought it and presented it to you. That struck me as an impulsive act.
It was an impulsive act. Yes, I was all of a sudden standing in the house and we were thinking I was just looking at it. And then he handed me the keys and said, it's yours.
So, good thing you liked it, huh?
It's a good thing that I did like it, is right.
Well, okay, Brenda. So your new book is out this year, Wings of Isis, And I know we want to talk about that, but, you know, you've been a priestess of Isis for a long time. Why don't we talk a little bit about the Isian tradition of Egyptian magic and, you know, how it's, you know, woven throughout your book and, you know, how it's sort of, you know, been part of your life for so many years as a contemporary priestess. As I like to say, you know, we're walking this ancient path, you know. So why don't you tell us how it manifests in, you know, in a contemporary priestess's life?
Well, the Isian tradition, you know, there are a lot of philosophies of Egyptian magic that are out there, you know, in the modern day. You know, there's the Golden Dawn, which is very regimented, very structured, very high magic-y. I mean, and then there is the Wiccan traditions that are very, like, earth-based type of stuff. But it's, and what it would be is, you would take the Wiccan earth-based magic and kind of put an overlay of Egyptian tradition over it, like the deities. And that's one thing that's being used these days. The Isian tradition goes back to the original magic and ritual that was done in the temples and for the people back then, back in ancient Egypt. And a lot of the rituals in my book are translated from the from different papyrus as well. A lot of the spells, a lot of the rituals, the temple setup, the elemental associations, all of that. It's very, I mean, it's very traditional in the sense that it's pretty straightforward on how they did it back then. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And yeah.
But now the worship of Isis changed through Egyptian history. Is there a kind of a short but yet understandable explanation you can give us for how it how it evolved and changed?
Well, you know, I believe that there are some goddesses that are that have so much energy and so that are so powerful that through the ages they morph into different, you know, into different. You know, I wouldn't want to say characters, but identities. And, you know, Isis being one of the longest worshipped goddesses on Earth has, you know, she started out basically like, you know, as a mother goddess, and then she progressed and became more sophisticated, and she added many more attributes, you know, the goddess of healing, you know, all of her psychic and intuitive stuff, the goddess of the land, the people, you know, all of that, and she evolved over the years just like humankind has evolved over the years, and that's because she's been around so long. Now, from various times, like, of course, she started in Egypt, her archetype, she, and I believe, and I state this in the book, that just like, you know, Jesus was a real person at one point, that Isis and her consort Osiris were real people, and they became deified.
And so where do you think they came from, Brenda? I mean, I guess now we're starting to touch on maybe, I mean, I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, it's perfectly okay. You know how some of the Egyptologists, you know, in that geologist whose name I can't recall at the moment, believe that the Sphinx is really like 10,000 years old and that there's water erosion.
I believe
erosion.
That as well.
You
yeah,
do?
I believe
so,
that.
So you're thinking Isis and Osiris probably, you know, date back more than 10,000 years. Would that
yes,
be safe to assume?
Yes, I do. There's many writings that confirm that. You know, Herodotus wrote about that as well. They were called, you know, the travelers from the West. And they, you know, they brought, because there's a period of Egyptian history where, you know, way back in the first, before the first dynasties, in which, you know, all of a sudden Isis and Osiris just show up, and they bring with them, you know, a language, a religious system, you know, and it had never been before occurred in the Nile Valley. The people were pretty primitive. They were living in mud huts. They didn't have, you know, they were almost like scavengers or hunter-gatherers. They didn't know how to grow crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so right around the fourth or fifth dynasty, boom, right there. So all of a sudden, they show up and they bring all this with them. So, you know, you can put two and two together. The Egyptians had a fascination for certain star in the solar system, the Sirius star, and the Sphinx itself, you know, and the pyramids, which are, I believe, almost nearly as old as the Sphinx, you know, the pyramids themselves. You know, 7,500 years ago, the constellation of Orion, they were directly aligned to it. So, you know, in order for that to happen, it has to be built at least that long ago. See what I mean?
Right, right, yeah, because it was in alignment with it, right.
It was in alignment with it, yeah. So there's a lot of things that are very mysterious. I find it fascinating. But and also the actual mummies of the earlier dynasties were a little bit different. The people were different. They weren't, because the Egyptians were a mix of all the surrounding countries, you know. But the earlier mummies had kind of different features. They weren't like more of a mixed race. They were more kind of they had lighter colored eyes too, and that's why they're always showing Isis with blue eyes.
Well, you know, I don't know if you saw this recently on the internet, and it was coming from some reliable sources like newspapers in Europe, mm-hmm. But they were talking about how Dr. Zahi Hawass would not comment on the DNA results of, I think it was Tutankhamun. They said that the DNA results showed that the DNA had him with a European ancestry. Now, I know you're talking about potentially from a star system, so you know, from mm-hmm. aliens, so to speak. You know, like the Kurt, Chariot of the Gods stuff.
That, and also in the writings of Herodotus, the Greek historian, the time of them arriving in Egypt kind of coincided a lot with the sinking of Atlantis, and they always said that the Atlanteans, it's been known they had knowledge from other, you know, from otherworldly knowledge. Do you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, because you've been to Egypt, there are things there that cannot be explained on how they did it back then, how they built these monuments, the medicine of that time. I mean, there is a lot of lost knowledge, and some of it can't be explained even now. Even some of the way they worked metal, gold, and things like that is completely lost, because it probably came from another solar system.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, look at the Dogon tribe. I think they're a primitive tribe that knew about the planets in, God, it's been so long since I read this, but I think if the planets in Orion's belt or something like that,
mm-hmm.
we only just discovered them like I think the 60s or something like that, a few decades ago, but
exactly.
They knew about them, you know, ages ago. So where did they get that information from if it wasn't from you know, some advanced teachers? And
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem wrapping my mind around that at all, quite frankly. And, well, you know, it also reminds me of I attended a class once where we were being taught to what they call aspect. In other words,
mm-hmm.
invite the goddess to sort of speak through us, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women who knew nothing about Sekhmet channeled Sekhmet,
mm-hmm.
and she spoke to the women in the room through this woman about being from a faraway star, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me.
You know, it makes perfect sense to me. And you know, the Mesopotamians as well, they had a whole one of their symbols in the Mesopotamian culture was that of DNA. And how would they know about DNA back
right.
then? See what I mean? And part of their writings were that the gods came down and bred with humans. And I believe that was very similar to what happened in Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I had as far as worshiping Isis or connecting with Isis, I want to get your opinion about something. I had a woman say to me once, she thought it was really sort of impossible for contemporary people to actually connect with these ancient deities because were so far removed from a time when they were actually worshipped. And I don't know, even though I had a lot of respect for this woman, I thought to myself, you know, if these are really deities, I don't think it matters whether we're talking to them in ancient Egypt or some language that's pre-Egyptian, or whether we're talking to them in English, you know, contemporary English. You know, if they're all-knowing, if they're all-powerful, if they are really deity, then that doesn't really make sense to me. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that that's a very, well, to me, that's ridiculous. And the reason why I say that is because as a psychic and as a priestess for, you know, over 26 years of my life, maybe longer, I mean, you can't help but know that there's something else out there, an energy, the super consciousness, as it were. What exists out in the super consciousness is, you know, is the energy that we receive from the Creator. Now, in the Egyptian philosophy, the Creator, sometimes it's shown as the sun, because that's the biggest star in the sky, but it's really the Creator, which is both male and female energy there. The deities themselves, the gods and the goddesses, with their different specific attributes, are how we make our connection. If we follow like a pagan path or an Egyptian path, is how we make our connection to the source, and they become very personal to us. That's what's so unique about working with deities, because oftentimes they choose us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't choose them. Do you know what I mean? They
choose
to be in our life, and they choose to be in our life as a companion, as a teacher, and, you know, it unfolds in whole different layers than if you're, you know, you are separate to them and, you know, you think of them as just like some inanimate idol. See what I mean?
Right, right, exactly. You have a relationship. It develops.
You develop a relationship, and this relationship is very real. It's a give and take.
Right,
you know,
right, yeah.
Through your devotion and your sacrifices, you know, you can, it's a beneficial relationship both ways.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, you know, because so often, you know, I hear people will, you know, if they always want to be on the receiving end, you know, it's always, what can the goddess do for me? And it's never, well, how are you in service to the goddess or your community or something like that? And I think it's important to point out that it's reciprocal.
It is. Well, you know, life in the world, if you really pay attention to nature, whatever is happening now in this very day, why things are so unbalanced, everything is polarity. Male, female, negative, positive, good, bad. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so in your relationship with a deity, I mean, who are you to expect something, you know? I mean, you can't
expect.
It's
pretty arrogant.
That's pretty arrogant, and it's also, you know, not an energy that promotes any kind of personal growth for you. So when working with your deity, you know, if you're to ask something of them, then you need to give back.
Right.
It's only a logical hello, you know.
Right. Well, it's just good manners even. I mean, if you want to even think of it on that level.
Exactly.
Well, now I do want to get into the book in the temple, but as long as we're on this subject, let's just take it a tiny bit further. For some of my listeners who maybe are new to this, or maybe are just coming to understand that there's a goddess out there, I know Isis comes to so many people, and she's really has always been throughout her whole history a very accessible goddess. You know, she's not. You know, how would you recommend to them they get to know her and start a relationship with her?
Well, you know, everybody's got their own specific, you know, feelings about connecting with a goddess. But what I would start with, I would start reading up on her and who she really is. And then I would immerse myself in some of the myths that surrounds her, some of her magical practices. I would familiarize myself first, and then I would get a picture, a statue, and then if you are wanting, just by that alone, then you could ask for her to come to you, do a little work with her. It's not, It wouldn't be something major. You could simply burn a candle. If you're just a complete newbie and you had a picture of Isis, then you could light that candle, and I would suggest a white candle, and make kind of a devotion to her. Remember, her archetype is the Virgin Mary as well.
Okay. So that's a real easy crossover for somebody who's maybe a Christian or a progressive Christian who maybe feels some affinity with Mary. You know, Isis is, you know, a goddess that's sort of parallel in attribute, in essence, I guess, is a way to say it.
Exactly, exactly. It's the same archetype, and you know, it's like what came first, the chicken or the egg? Hello.
Yeah.
And it's just like when my husband, you know, witnessed me going into a Catholic church and thought I was going to spontaneously combust. I went straight to the altar of Mary and the child, Jesus, and I lit a candle because to me it was the same thing.
Yeah, you know, me too. And I say that to some pagans, and they look at me wide-eyed, like they just can't quite get that. So, you know, I think there's a lesson there for pagans as well, you know, because
it
is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing that often confuses people is how do you tell Isis and Hathor apart? I mean, I know we have sometimes the Isis knot that sort of gives away Isis or gives away her priestesses, but if you don't have that Isis knot on the reliefs and you just have the sistrum in the hand and the solar disc and the horns, is there a trick to telling Isis from Hathor?
Well, usually it's in the crown. You know, it won't be horns. It'll be more of the rounded, almost like crescent moons on the side, and also an addition to it would be you would see her the symbol of the throne. Right there. That's what gives it away. That's what distinguishes it.
Well, I know the throne is Isis's symbol. So if you don't see the throne, you think it's a safe bet that it's probably Hathor.
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay. So now how are the two related, Isis and Hathor?
Well, you know, they are. Hathor is a goddess that evolved kind of almost like I would have to say an agricultural type of deity. And, I mean, she has many, she went through many, you know, challenges, and we won't get into her whole mythology, but she's an aspect of the goddess that represents, you know, beauty, womanhood, fertility. Her symbol is the cow in ancient Egypt. It was probably more like a water buffalo back then. And in her statues and in her carvings, you're going to see the big like cow ears. She's the counterpart, or she's the wife of the son of Isis and Osiris, which is Horus.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so what was your question on that? What is the difference between the two?
Is there a relationship? I mean, because Hathor was, I might have my history confused, but wasn't Hathor worshipped before Isis, and Isis's worship came along later, or does it depend on what part of Egypt we're talking about?
I think it depends on. It really depend on the different places in Egypt, because more where the priesthood and the temples were, and the more sophisticated worship were in the temples was more of an Isian tradition there. The Hathor, as you know, as a symbol of the cow and stuff, evolved from probably, you know, before. I mean, it was just an elemental goddess of the land before the advent of Isis and Osiris. You know, before they entered Egypt, it evolved from there, and she gained popularity with the people and the farmers, the people that you know are out there, the people of the land, in other words.
Yeah. Okay.
Because You know, I mean, you've been to Egypt. You see the water buffaloes there that are just, I mean, they're part of the whole landscape. They're part of the whole, they're woven through the whole of the fellaheen or the farmers, you know?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, I will never forget one particular image as, you know, when you're in Egypt, you cruise down the Nile on these small ships. And, you know, they're not like the big Carnival or Princess Cruise Line ships.
Right,
they're much
right.
smaller. And I'll never forget one scene where the kids were actually playing with the water buffalo in the Nile, jumping off its back like it was a diving board. I mean, it was their family pet almost, but I'm sure it also, you know, gave milk or, you know, and probably
it
pulled the plow.
It makes the cheese from it, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, so it is, you know, it's a part of the family and these agricultural communities in a way that I think we contemporary people here, especially in the United States and the West, if you're not from a farm, you just can't really comprehend. You think those days are gone, but they're really not.
Yes, and the water buffalo was one of the first domesticated from those ancient peoples. So, you know,
okay.
The water buffalo was definitely, a provider of the land. See what I mean?
Right, right. Yeah, and well, and you think about the, you know, that just that cow family, you know, how the cow is also sacred to the Hindus in Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, and they use everything from, you know, everything that the cow has. I mean,
the meat,
urine,
the
feces,
leather,
and everything.
Everything, yeah.
Right. So now, but we have about 15 minutes left. Time has already flown. The roles of the temples in Egypt, you get into the temples in your book, Wings of Isis. Talk a little bit about the roles of the temples.
Okay. Well, what I tried to present in the book, because it was very important to me, because it kind of went along with our trips. You remember the trips we take and the different specific, each temple was, there was a main deity associated with those temples. And the temples are places for the populace to come, to find healing, to worship, to connect with their deities, that specific deity. During the times, there was always festivals. Each one of the temples had specific festivals at times of the year. They were centers of worship. They were also centers of healing, and they were also centers of, you know, providing the people with certain things, like the poor and stuff. They were like almost like community centers of the ancient world. Yeah.
Well,
the magic in the temples, magic and ritual. And astrology and numerology and all that, people don't realize that ancient Egypt was a 100% magical society. And the only thing that compares to it these days is India, because India has had an unbroken religion as well.
Right. Well, and also healing. I mean, we have to remember that back when we're talking about two, it probably wasn't quite the desert it is now. I mean, I remember reading that book by Jonathan Cott, which I would so wholly recommend to anyone listening to the show that's interested in Egypt and goddesses. He writes about the contemporary woman Amseti, who believed, and you know, she only died in 1980. She was an English woman, and she was having flashbacks from a past life.
Amseti, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, when she talked about when the temples, you know, were gardens and lush and beautiful, and it made me think about when we were in Dendera, the Temple of Hathor there with the beautiful columns that had her bovine image, you know, like the like the sacred cow. And remember, off to the side was the area where it used to be a sacred lake. And, of course, it was empty now. There was no water, but that's where people used to go to take the cure, you know.
But remember, down those steps, there was still a little water and underground coming from underground.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you remember that part, but you could go down those steps that were, like, there was the main where the taking the cure place was, but then there was some steps you could go down. There was still water down there.
Yeah. Well, because you're a psychic and a priestess, and you know, you probably are a little bit better tuned into that collective unconscious that we were talking about before. I know this is sort of shifting gears a little bit, but I wonder if you have any intuitions about this paradigm shift that everybody seems to be feeling and talking about and thinks is maybe coming. I mean, do you have any insights as to what you think it might really be, or is it going to be just another, Y2K hoax and, nothing? Or what are your thoughts?
You're talking about 2012.
Well, maybe do you think it's going to really be 2012? I mean, what do you think is coming? Are you getting any glimmers, or what do you say about it?
No, I don't feel it's going. One of the things that I do see, that I have been seeing, and I know that even in Chinese astrology, this is the year of the tiger. It's the year of natural disasters, and I know that these natural disasters are going to occur. But I feel that the shift itself it's going to affect all areas of society. And one of the things that I'm seeing emerging through this, and it could even be happening now, is that the feminine energy or the female energy is going to start to take precedence over the patriarchal society, because we're at the breaking point with that really, and I can tell people honestly, because I read people, I give psychic readings, that's my business, and I probably do on an average about 80 readings a week, and I can tell you that there's no jobs out there. The jobs are very hard to find. However, the women are working more than the men, so that tells me that, the feminine energy and their influence in society is coming to the forefront. And I really feel that that's going to be part of it, even if you don't want to admit it or not, because you have some very strong religions out there that are totally patriarchal religions. The Islam, the fundamental Christian religions, that energy is not a creator. It's a destroyer, do you see what I mean? Without getting too political.
Right.
Whereas we may have to break down all this stuff in order to bring back something nurturing, right?
Right.
That's what I see.
Well,
are you talking about specific predictions?
Well, I don't know. Do you have any? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you feel like if there's anything you might want to say that you feel comfortable sharing?
Well, I know I have I really feel that our next president here in the United States is going to be a woman.
Oh, God, not Sarah Palin.
I don't know who it's going to be yet, but you see, I always get my epiphanies I know this is going to sound terrible, when I'm cleaning horse manure out of my stalls, when I've predicted every president. I don't know what that means, but, people call me on the phone during the time of the presidential race, and they go, who's it going to be? I'm like, it hasn't come to me yet, as I'm shoveling.
Okay.
I'm not sure yet. But it will be, I believe it's going to be a woman.
Well, that's a scary thought.
I don't know if it's going to be a scary thought. Maybe it'll be a good thing. Who knows?
Okay. Well, I mean, the only woman that seems in the running right now that has any chance, at least in terms of public opinion, is Sarah Palin. And that would be a 2012 disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, well, maybe there'll be somebody else, though.
Yeah.
There could be someone else emerging.
Well, people are talking about, is it possible, that the Democrats could run Hillary, and I don't know if that can really happen, but, I could wrap my mind around that and feel safe at night.
Well, that might not be a bad choice, actually.
Right.
Because she's definitely had the experience. She's been through the ranks, and she's tough.
Right, right. And actually, I'm beginning to think she would have been more tougher than Obama's been, you know. So,
That has always been my opinion. I always thought it's too bad that she got railroaded out of that. Really, what happened was unfair.
Yeah.
If it would have been a different scenario if she would have made it, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people, myself included, I mean, at least the way things are going right now, that, you know, that wishes that it would have been Hillary and not Obama that we all backed, you know. But, well, getting back to, you know, Goddess and the Sacred Feminine and all of this, you know, as a priestess of the Sacred Feminine, you know, I know some people don't really have a good idea about, you know, what it's really like to be a priestess in contemporary times. You know, some of them have these really weird notions that we do really strange things, and then others just can't fathom, you know, how mundane it is. You know, give us an example of what your, you know, what your day or week looks like as a priestess.
Let's see. I put my pants on one leg at a time. I'm kidding. you know, I believe it's always been my philosophy, and I've been a high priestess. I was a priestess before I was a high priestess, but I've been a high priestess since 1988. So it's a lot of responsibility. It really is. I mean, especially if you run a group, and my group, the Grove of the Green Cobra, has been together for 20 years, and we. But it takes. You have to want it. You have to want to work with people. You have to be really dedicated to the work. And the being dedicated to the work means, you know, it's with you every day, really.
Yeah.
In your thoughts, the way you do things, being aware of the phases of the moon, the rhythms of the stars, just doing the work. I call it doing the work, and I even consider my psychic stuff as doing the work. You know, because really when people ask me about the psychic stuff, you know, they go, oh, you're gifted. I go, you know what, I'm just a channel for this.
Right.
I channel this. I just happen to be a more fortunate channel than some people. You know what I mean? More
right,
open
right.
Or more. Now, there are people, everybody's psychic. Everybody has psychic abilities. Some have more than others, and some are truly gifted. You know, I think that I've been, you know, blessed by the goddess to be able to help people and to have this be my kind of mission in life, as it were. See what I mean? And I believe that if you are a priestess, you are in service to humanity in whatever form that takes.
Well, and you know, you said in service, and I think that is so key, because, you know, so often, I've found that, you know, when people find the goddess, the first thing they want to do is be a priestess, and then the next thing they want to do is be ordained, and they don't really realize what a path of service this is. You know, it really is not about being in power. It's not about ego.
No, and it's not about ego, and I want, like, to clear the air, and some people might get, you know, angry with me for saying this, but that is one of my pet peeves. So often do people want to jump that step and not do the work and become a priestess under a tree. Well, you know what? It doesn't work that way. The goddess really is never going to give you any power unless you work for it. Sorry.
right. And then even
you know
the power
I mean?
You have is the power you have is to teach. The power you have is to heal.
Exactly.
And then, you know, your power
healing
is
the magic.
Yeah, yeah. The power is just enabling you to be of more service.
Well, you know, it's what you choose. That's why, you know, not everybody chooses to be a priestess.
Right,
not
absolutely.
Everybody is as crazy as we are, Karen.
Well, you know what? It has been a slippery slope for me, and I've never looked back, and I've never regretted it one minute, because, you know what? She has just made my life so incredible, and, you
oh,
know,
absolutely.
I
wouldn't trade it for anything. The goddess has given me almost everything in my life that I've asked for.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I will work for her with my last breath. So.
Well, me too. Absolutely. I mean, I can say that everything in my life has come from the goddess. And I've worked for it. I've worked with her. And I've had a lot of doors open that And I know it was the work of the goddess. I know it was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it yeah, I mean, just the way things fall into place sometimes, you know it's magic. It's magic happening.
Absolutely.
So you just have to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Brenda, so your book is Wings of Isis, and now it's put out by O Books, and you can just order it on Amazon, or do you have a better recommendation?
Yeah. Well, you can order it through Amazon. That would be the easiest. I mean, you can order it through any bookstore, Barnes
okay.
& Noble or whatever. You can order
right.
it through any bookstore. Go ahead.
Well, and I was going to say, if someone wanted to get a reading from you or wanted to know more about Grove of the Green Cobra or something like that, how do they reach you?
It's very simple. Just Google Lady Brenda, High Priestess. And all my information is out there, bared to the world.
You and me both, and we're not hiding behind some phony name.
Definitely not, okay? So
okay.
Just Google Lady Brenda, High Priestess, and there you go.
Okay. And, I haven't asked you this in a while, but are you planning any trips to Egypt anytime soon?
Well, you know what? I want to plan a trip to Egypt. I have something in the can. I have some people seriously looking to make a documentary on my book. And so every time I think it goes away, it comes right back. And that's going to be the trip that I'll put together.
Okay.
To have
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
About 6 months out.
Okay. Well, Brenda, thank you for taking the time to be in on the show tonight. And I appreciate
Thanks
all your...
Thanks for having me.
Your insights on Isis and the priestess work and the prophecies and where Isis really comes from. I appreciate you being courageous to speak those things.
You know what? I'm an open book, and I don't care if anybody challenges me. They might send me a hate blog, but whatever.
I doubt it. You got Isis protecting you.
That's right.
there you go. Well, Brenda,
All
thank
right.
you so much. And again, listeners, her book is Wings of Isis, and I highly recommend Brenda and her book. So, well, Brenda, good night, and tell Chris hi, and I'll let you get back to whatever it was you were doing.
Okay. You have a good one. Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, sometimes called the feminine consciousness, and whether the great she, as I like to call her, be in your mind as a deity, an archetype, or ideal. We talk here about how these values and benchmarks just will save the world. And we were talking in our first part of the show with Lady Brenda McCoy, author of Wings of Isis, and I hope you'll look her up. Brenda has really been a wonderful teacher to me over the years, and I highly recommend her. Well, we are coming to the second part of the show now, and I see that my second guest, Ruth Gould Goodman, is waiting there. And before we get to this delightful teacher and healer, I want to read you a bit about who she is and her bio. There's a lot here, but suffice it to say, she is... a licensed, a California licensed acupuncturist, and let's see, she has an MA in dance therapy from New York University, and she is the author of the new book, not out very long, The Sacred Book of You, Unveiling the Lost Teachings of the Deep Feminine. She's also a poet, a visionary philosopher, energy healer, and pioneer explorer in the neuroplasticity of our brain and the somatic wisdom of our body. And we will get her to explain just what that means. So, Ruth, welcome to the show. Oh, wait a minute. Let me see. Maybe she can't hear me. Just one second.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Ruth. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
yes.
I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me, so I'm glad.
You know what? That was my fault. I forgot to click a little button I was supposed to click. I was so wrapped up in reading your bio, I forgot to do that, so I apologize.
fine. That's fine. I'm so happy to be with you.
Well, I'm so glad to finally have you on the show. I certainly enjoyed reading your book and giving you an endorsement. And, you know, now finally we can talk together and share with my listeners all that wisdom that was between those two covers.
I know I crammed a lot into that book. I realized that I could have written three books out of that one book. But, you know, I had to get it all done. But I'm so glad to thank you for reading it, and I'm really glad for what you do in having these conversations, because I'm aware of the fact that when we talk, when we have conversations, there's a catalytic process that goes on in the conversation in which new information and new possibilities can be brought forward, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, good. Well, me too. And, you know, I think, you know, this radio show is really one of my guilty pleasures. I so love these conversations. You know, I feel like, you know, whenever I give somebody a platform for their work, I learn so much, and I'm sure my listeners learn so much, and maybe even my guests, you know, learn as well. And, you know, this is the way of the sacred feminine, you know. You know, this is just one of the different ways I believe that, you know, the world will change from, you know, the patriarchal paradigm to, you know, the paradigm of the sacred feminine. So how would you like to start? Do you want to, you know, tell listeners a little bit about the focus of your work?
I would love to. I am coming from the world of being a healer, working with bodies, working with energy, working with dance, working with movement. I have been learning from my relationship with my body, my relationship with other people's bodies, that our bodies are encoded with a profound intelligence, the intelligence that is everything. And in the process of my personal healing, I realized that one of the pieces of the of information that I needed to bring online in order to be able to actually rewire myself, re-heal myself, reconstruct myself, was my relationship with what I'm going to call the birthing membrane, that place in my consciousness that in which my finite, my unique, individuated consciousness is interfacing with the infinite. I recognized that energetically, a lot of the twistings, a lot of the addictive behaviors, a lot of the compulsions that were in me were actually a response to a world that had taught me not be in relationship with that infinite process, had taught me to mistrust it, had taught me to doubt it, had taught me actually to revile it and hate it. As I moved into it and danced with it and found my way with that part of myself, I realized that I was looking at the deep feminine, that part, that womb space that is not, I must say, you know, it is about the feminine and women's bodies, but it's also even deeper than that. It's the very structure of existence we're talking about, the yin-yang, that inside of every cell.
So you're talking about something that men have as well. This isn't just women have.
Absolutely. And there's a relation. We both have two hemispheres of the brain. We both have cellular structures that are demanding that the dynamics of yin and yang are dancing in an active polarity. Our world has been suppressing, denying, flattening out its relationship with this Shakti, with this infinite energy. And it is making, we're very ill right now because of it. And I'm so grateful for the resurgence of you know, it has to be. The goddess, the feminine, the deep feminine, it's her time now. I have a theory, Karen, And this is something that came to my mind out of my healing practice. Every time I would go in and work with people, there seemed to be a deeper logic to what seemed like something that was bad or evil or something you wanted to get rid of. When we entered into that stuff that was the addiction, the compulsion, or the negative feeling, and got deeper into it, there began to be a logic to its expression.
So are you saying the addictions were just a symptom of something bigger?
They were a desperate attempt of the intelligence of the being to get the attention of the conscious mind.
To look within, and
point way to say pay attention.
Yeah.
And because people are so deeply schismed, so deeply fragmented, they every time this information comes forward, there's a no. It's like in an attempt to put it underneath the rug, to feel shame, to feel guilt, to feel negation, to feel self-hatred, and to try to, you know, effort to become something else, to overcome it, instead of entering the information and beginning to understand that there's a deeper logic to this compulsion. And when there's a shift in the relationship to the information from one of trying to dominate oneself to entering into the body as an intelligent process that is attempting to communicate something. So there's you're in an equal terrain all of a sudden in which this information is no longer being negated.
Well, and I think this might be a good time to remind listeners, because I think I said it at the top of the hour, but that was an hour ago. Let me remind them what the show topic is. It's healing our trauma, healing our world, or you might call it the cosmic tango, dancing with the creative potential of the infinite to self-heal. Now, Ruth, is this anything like Reiki, or is this something totally different?
Reiki is a name for a particular quality of relationship with the energy of existence. And there's a particular way that people are taught to be conductive with this. Sometimes I like to take names off of things because they're especially this energy and have an interface with it to ask it, you know, who are you? What are you? What do you want from me? How am I going to establish a relationship with this present moment, with this possibility to create harmony, to create balance, to allow for a healing, wholing integration to happen.
So Ruth, go ahead. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
No, it does have a. It is what Reiki plays with, but for me, it is a dimension beyond a word.
Now, would you go so far as to say, I mean, you mentioned, you know, obsessions, addictions. Would you go so far as to say if someone has a disease that, cancer, diabetes, whatever, are we talking about the same thing? Is that, the body trying to get our attention?
I believe, you know, there are many levels at which we can look at this information. Some of it is very individual. It's about our individual life. Some of it is about our social group. Some of it is about our society. Some of it is about our whole relationship to the cosmos and the world. So when I look at disease process in people, I'm not going to say 100%, but I'm going to say 98% of it is an expression of a misalignment with life at some level. And it doesn't have to just be that person's misalignment. It can also be within the cultural context and their attempt to fit into a culture that is misaligned.
Well, there's a question forming in my head. You know, I'm thinking to myself, well, if that's the case, then it isn't always our fault. You know, maybe where we're born, what culture we're born into, but it's something that still potentially wreaks havoc with our behavior, with our health. I mean, is this a stretch? Am I getting it or no?
Okay. The blame game doesn't work here because what we're looking at are states of unconsciousness, deep recesses in our own somatic world of areas in which, because of our level of knowledge, we have no access to. So it's not a blaming thing, but there are stories of people who are able to heal themselves because they have entered into the information of their disease. They've entered into their body, into the cellular structures, the structures of their organ systems, and they begin to have a conscious relationship with the information and are able to receive something about the story that is underlying
Well, Ruth, let me ask you to talk in examples. I understand better using examples, it feels less abstract that way.
Yes. You know, one of the things that I can talk about is an example of addiction, because I deal a lot with that, you know, relationship addiction or food addiction. And let's say, for example, somebody has an eating disorder and they are trying to heal this process, and their body is in a lot of pain, their emotions are in a lot of pain. They are traumatized by their own behaviors. They cannot control it. They're attempting on the outside, from the external, to stop the behavior. But they can't. And they need to go into the body and listen to the energies of the body as the addiction is happening. And I'm going to give you an example of something that actually comes out of my life. A point in my life when I was healing from an eating disorder, and I found myself in a behavioral pattern of seeking food when I knew that the food would have nothing to do with healing me or giving me or satisfying me or fulfilling me in any way. I go to seek the food. I open the closet. I'm looking inside the closet, and I'm realizing that I'm seeking something from this object here. I'm seeking, what is it? And I realize that I'm seeking love, that I want the experience of connectedness. I want the experience of love. And I want it, and somehow I have objectified love as something that's outside of me that I can put inside my mouth and consume.
Okay.
And so I all of a sudden realize that I'm putting love in an object, and I go and I scan my body and I feel, I say, well, where is the not love inside of me? So I scan my body and I feel a place that is fragmented, that hurts, that feels very bad. And
Are you literally talking about a part of your body?
Yes.
Okay.
An emotional feeling of stagnation and negativity, of self-hatred. Well, it might be considered a place of self-hatred. But it's not self-hatred energetically. It is just stagnant energy. So what I found myself doing was realizing that I had learned to structure love as an external thing. And I realized I was creating the love in that bag of crackers, that I could pull that sense of love back to my body. The moment that I actually created that love within my own body soma, the compulsion fell away completely. I was free, completely free. And I realized that I was looking at an unconscious structuring of my mind and the way that I had learned to structure love as something external to myself, that I had not been taught to hold love as my essential nature, my essential being. And what was interesting at this moment was I walked away and I was free, but within five steps, the unconscious pattern pulled me back, and I found myself doing this repetitive behavior, in a sense rewiring an old habit of creating love external to myself. This kind of patterning of the way that we are structuring energies and beliefs is the substrate of our well-being or our not well-being. That we are creating patterns, energetic patterns. And some of these patterns are patterns of that are imprinted on us from very old and dysfunctional wirings that I look at it as a lineage that's 5,000 years old that have to do with a deep negation of life, deep negation of the feminine that is being recapitulated in our unconscious relationship to our world around us.
So you're saying these things that are affecting us go beyond this current life. They go, they're like in our ancestral DNA or something.
Yes, and but they're a lineage too. It's the way my mother held me and my grandmother held her and my great-great-grandmother held her. It's the integration of the patterns of trauma that go into the unconscious that keep coming forward until they are finally looked at and made conscious and are able in that consciousness, in being held from a place of present moment integration, present moment sense of one's centrality to actually be able to reintegrate itself. I have to just say, the thing about this work that I find so interesting, Karen, is that the relationship with what it is that is our disease process that allows for the healing to happen is actually a relationship of surrender, of not doing, of allowing our consciousness to begin to enter the body as a whole system, an intelligent system, and be able to invite the energies to have a place to unwind, to literally take the attention out of the intellect where most people hold their attention, and let, it's like pulling it down so that it comes down into a sense of the organ systems, the breath, the pelvis, the knees, the feet, the toes, the sense of walking on the earth, of being part of the earth, and of the body being a living, intelligent process. And so much of what our disease process is about is that we keep trying to dominate this intelligence, and we don't know how to make space for it, because in fact it is a self-healing, self-generating, formatting intelligence.
Well, it's certainly not anything we've been taught.
No, we've been taught to actually do everything in our education. There's nothing in our education that is teaching us how to attend to this and how to make space for it, how to talk to it, how to have relationship with it. And this is actually, for me, this is an aspect of the feminine. This is the matrix aliveness that each of us carries. This is the living goddess within us.
So, Ruth, all right, is this something that
Karen?
It is, but it's deep, you know? I mean, it's not simple. It's a complex idea, I think. And if you've never heard it before, it seems, you know, it doesn't, maybe it doesn't feel familiar, you know?
This is a paradigm shift of vast proportion. It's like looking outside to the natural world and seeing how it is that there's trees grow, the rain comes, the animals reproduce. There's this incredible cycle of becoming that is totally interconnected with everything. And there's a living process that seems to understand how to balance itself, seems to understand how to create itself.
I think I'm starting to get that it's sort of like this invisible force that permeates everything that's also within our DNA. Is that an oversimplified way of explaining it?
It's not oversimplified. It's almost it, but I want to even take it out of the DNA. I want to say that this is like it's encoded in every cell. It holds the polarities of the dream of life that the body is, that we are it. It's, you know, I used to you know, in the Sanskrit prayer, namaste, I used to say, the God within salutes the God inside of you. And I realized that I had to take out the word inside, because inside could be as far away as outside. That what I had to say was, my divine being salutes your divine being. And I had to recognize that divinity as a present moment experience of everything. So sometimes when we think of it as DNA,
mm-hmm.
it becomes far away.
It limits
away.
It. It seems like it's probably limiting.
Right. It's far away, and it's not as present as it really is.
Okay. How do you then, I mean, I know this is, it feels like this is probably a big subject and isn't something we're going to totally get in 1 hour, but maybe we can start to understand it. I mean, how do people learn this, or I think you used the term rewire. How do we get in touch with this to be able to help ourselves?
First of all, I just want to thank you for being such an intelligent and open-minded interviewer. You're just great.
Thank you.
I appreciate you. And this material is not easy. It is a paradigm shift. And I understand it, and the process of languaging it is not easy. So the way that people get in touch with this is by entering the body. Now, a lot of people do yoga. A lot of people do a lot of physical things. They still are in a dominator relationship with their body. They're in a dominator relationship with the yoga. There is a way of entering the body in which you ask, it's a flowering. There's a way of connecting with the breath. And the breath actually speaks to this at every moment. The breath actually recapitulates the cycles of existence. In every breath, the birth and death are right there. The whole cycle is right there. And then you have this physical body, and you have a spine, and you have a central channel. And it's possible to begin to pay attention to how it is that this breath breathes through you. Not by making the breath breathe, but by listening to the breath, by inviting the breath, to be breathed. And when this is done, a window opens up, and there's an understanding that breath is a gift, and that we all are being breathed by the cosmos, that this is not something to be taken for granted. We are being given life at every breath. And that the whole universe is breathing, and we are being breathed with the cosmos. So there's an attention that we start to pay to the breath. This is very subtle. This is not work for everybody, but it is the work that I believe helps people to get in touch with the embodied goddess. Because in paying attention to how it is that this chronic subtle energy infuses our body, and how it is that our conscious mind can begin to understand how we are saying yes or no to this vitality, and how it is that we are creating relationship with her, we begin to become more adept and more conscious of how to create what I would call a relationship that makes her happy. And the relationship that would make her happy is really a marriage, a deep marriage between the masculine and feminine, a deep marriage between the personality and the infinite, a deep marriage between present moment and the timeless. And go ahead.
This technique, okay, I'm going to use it, say technique, is it something that someone who doesn't work with you in person can learn to do on their own? I mean, I know you've just written your book. I mean, or do you teach the techniques in the book, or is it something you have to sort of watch on a videotape? Or, I mean, how does one start to get this, to practice it, to know if they're tapping into this subtle energy?
You know, it's an initiation. It's an initiation into a realm of gentleness that most people bypass. And so I feel like sometimes people have to be with me for one or two sessions to learn to back off, to learn to be even more gentle, even more gentle.
So when you say gentle, is it that this is so subtle that we're looking for something that we don't recognize it because it's so subtle?
Yes. And when there is a gentling and backing off, and it's the difference between having an agenda, thinking that you're doing it, or finally getting to the place where you're allowing your body to be a living process and you're paying attention to it. At that moment, the moment that you back off from the agenda of trying to fix it, trying to do something, trying to make it happen, there's the capacity to perceive this energy. It isn't so far away, it isn't so subtle that it's impossible, but we're so full of noise, of thinking that we have to do it, that we miss it. So I feel like my work is to really help guide the way people pay attention and show them how it is that they are resisting this experience. And there's a lot of resistance to it, because we've been taught to be afraid of it. We've been taught to be afraid of the vast ocean that opens up.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. I would be so curious. I wouldn't be I don't think I would be afraid at all. I would be more afraid. It would be so subtle. I'm the type that you have to sort of sometimes hit me between the eyes with a 2x4, you know. So I'm always worried I'm going to miss the subtle.
I am sure that you are fearless, and that you would not.
Does it seem that way, Ruth? It doesn't feel that way.
I want you on my side. I want you on my side. No, it's It's a relationship with your body that it's an expansion that includes. It's like it includes this sense of this hum of what is given. That you're not imposing on it. You are realizing that something is given here. What is given? What is already given? And it's alive. And you are that life. And you, in connecting with this, there's a sense in which you understand that you're part of everything. This energy is not just, it permeates. It is you and it permeates. And you begin to have a direct sense of just how interconnected your being is with everything.
Well, you know, just on a, I don't know, social, political, humanity basis, if we all knew how to do this, wow, what a difference it could make in the world.
You're pushing a button because I know that this relationship, this is what creates strength. When somebody has this and they're connected with it, they're connected with a knowledge that is unstoppable. You know something, and you know that even if you were to look at your enemy, you have the capacity to penetrate deeper than the surface and understand the traumatized, you know, angry, hurt being that has been kept away from this knowledge, because if they had this knowledge, they would never be acting in such a violent way. Because this knowledge is actually the capacity to open one's being to the infinite conductivity of the creative process. So that, you know, I have an experience of, you know, when I meet challenges, when I'm having to encounter somebody that is really negative and they're talking to me, and I will feel myself go to an old place of shutting down, you know, of defense, and then I say to myself, no, you know, you have to stay connected to your breath, connected to this conductive energy. And what happens is that if I really allow myself to be present to this energy, I will feel this energy start to unwind through me and intelligently meet the challenge that's in front of me. It's as if my whole nervous system is being transformed in the present moment. All of a sudden, I'm looking out of my eyes and I'm seeing this person from a totally different perspective.
So you're looking beyond the ugliness.
And
seeing
and
them on a much
the
deeper level.
And so I can problem solve from another level. I have this infinite creativity moving through me that's seeing things not from the place of fear or narrowness, but from the infinite potential, and there's always a way.
Hmm.
So there's a way that this energy isn't just amorphous. It really problem solves and does understand. It does. It goes to wherever it's directed. If you understand how to be with it, and there are laws, though, because you see, if you see yourself as patriarchal, top down, you know, not connected, you're disconnected from it immediately. It responds to your relationship with it. So if you are in relationship with it and you understand that you're part of a living process and equal to everything, then that energy is going to be there with you and helping you survive, because that's what it does.
So if someone takes a session with you and starts to learn this, what does that session look like? I mean, I don't know how else to ask the question.
There are many ways I'm working. One of them is someone would come in with something in their life that is not working, a relationship that has gone bad, an inability to make a living, a compulsive, addictive process that they don't know how to deal with. And the information is right there in their body. So what we do is I track with them because I'm a clairsentient, and I feel when they have a particular thought form, I feel the structure of energy in their body. And so
wait. What is a clairsentient?
I feel energy. I feel it. If somebody has a thought, it will create a pattern. And I will feel that pattern. I'll feel how it's moving through them. And because I can feel it so acutely, I'm able to ask them to stop. I'm asking them to go to that place because the body doesn't lie. The body tells the truth. And so I'll ask them to connect with that feeling. Let's say, for example, there was a woman I was working with today who had a, it was almost like a plate that moved through her solar plexus and was cutting her body in half. And there was a story, an old story of a way that she had to disconnect from her deeply passionate nature in order to, and even though she was very passionate, she had to make it wrong. She had to judge it. She couldn't just be passionate. And so, you know, I was asking her to just track this and the information of her childhood, the information of her past. It was all encoded in this energetic structure in her solar plexus, which became available to her once her mind went to that place. So I track energy, and I help somebody to decode the energetics to have it become a working knowledge that can help them rewrite the stories that have been unconsciously holding their trauma in their body. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I guess I'm still trying to get a visual of what the two of you do together. I mean, I know you use your talent as a clairsentient, but you're sensing the energy. What is the person doing? I mean, are they talking?
I'm asking them to go in, and sometimes I have them become the character, move the energy, talk the energy, bring it into the present moment as an aspect. Sometimes people will come in with some part of themselves that they don't like at all and they want to get rid of. And I will connect with the pattern that energy is in their body, and I'll ask them to take the shape of it. I'll ask them to start to exaggerate that shape, and then it'll start to coalesce into a character, and then I'll start to talk with that character with them. And over and over and over, these structures aren't what they initially appeared to be. They're usually aspects of their being that have had to distort in order for them to survive a very traumatic childhood. And
I would love to be a fly on the wall and watch one of these sessions. This sounds so interesting. Or this would make a wonderful workshop. I mean, but you probably can't do this in a workshop. You probably have to do it one-on-one, right?
Well, you know, the thing that I do in workshops, I actually am going to be giving a workshop this Saturday at under my tent from 1 to 4. The thing that I do is I prime the pump with people by taking them into a journey of their bodies with very, very slow, very precise movement, so that they begin to feel that the energy in their mouth, the energy in the back of their head and through their whole throat and down through right to their genitals is connected, that there's a wiring there. And so I'll have them do very, very simple movements that allow that stream to start to be felt. And then I will do it both with forward bending and backward bending and twisting and working with the, you know, activating the wires of the legs so that the subtle energy, it's not so subtle, it's just the fact is that there's an energy that we are, that most of the time we're not paying attention to, and we're circulation, there's a circulation of energy that our whole body is. And I'm creating a space for people to start to attend to this and feel it.
Well, would you say that most people don't know how to recognize or feel that energy? I mean, like if you tell people to do what you just described, do most of them get it right off the bat? Or
Nope. It's like once again, paradigm shift. Because the way that I'm asking people to enter the body is, once again, gentle, slow, loving, kind, moving the mind, recognizing that the mind moves, and when the mind moves, the mind creates wirings, subtle wirings, and the mind, you know, there's a learning of how it is that our mind is creating relationship with the physical body. And
so it's almost like you sort of take it on faith in a sense, maybe that's not the best language to use, but it's almost like you fake it and until you sort of get it, kind of.
Yes. But what we're doing is we're saying that it's the not doing that's the doing. It's about allowing. It's about listening. It's
trusting.
About,
probably trusting.
Yes. Because what we're going for is what's already there. What we're going for is the life force that every animal is in touch with this. We're not, because we live in our heads.
Okay.
You watch the animal move and you see that they're there, it. We aren't, because we have been taught to schism and cut from it and live in our heads. It's not so far away. It's a matter of changing the paradigm to trust our body and listen.
So you say that this is scary to people, that the deep, you know, connecting to this deep feminine is scary. I mean, why is that? I mean, is it even scary to, like, women like us who, you know, want this balance, this shift, this sacred feminine back in the world?
I can tell you that for myself, what was hiding my relationship to it was shame. That what the doorway to this energy in me was the doorway of shame, because I had been taught to feel ashamed of not having all the answers, not having it all sewn up, not getting straight A's, not having it all on top, you know, to know this, to know that, to name this, to, you know, to have it all in something I could grab at and say, I know. And so I'd been taught to never just hang out and trust not knowing. I'd been taught to grab at things and to make things happen. And so there was a lack of education. And in fact, an inverse education out of the knowledge. You know, I remember reading about architecture without architects, and realizing that primitive peoples were creating incredible architecture without going to architecture school. That there was an innate understanding of how to work with materials and how to create these incredibly complex buildings. That this was in our system. But we have a system of education that kind of, you know, negates all that and says you have to learn this, 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 and this has to measure this way, and this has to go this way. And so that very organic process of
was lost.
Is
lost.
Yeah,
so, that makes sense to me.
And that is actually in our being. It's what heals us. It's what creates our next possibility. We've been cut from it. We've been severed from it. And when you're cut from it and severed from it, you feel afraid. And your world is defined by fear. And one of the ways, when your world is defined by fear, there's a tendency to act in harsh or violent ways, because all of a sudden your problem solving is limited to this narrow range, and either you win or you lose, and you're ready to go to war. And Is this making? I had to jump.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a huge subject. I mean, and it could go in so many directions. And we have like 5 minutes left. So.
Oh my God.
I
want to tell people to read my book.
How do you want to spend the next our last 5 minutes? What is the important points you want to make?
I invite people to understand that the journey to the feminine, one of the first places that each of us must go to is to enter our bodies, to taste our saliva, feel our breath, and invite a relationship that is unagended, that non-agended, to just hang out with the physicality and listen. Listen, because that's where she is. And when there is a connection to that, there's an immediate energetic reestablishment of our interconnectedness with everything. It's right there. But we live in our heads and we try to find the knowledge through the intellect because that's the pathway that was given to us.
Okay. Ruth, your book, again, I want to make sure I mention the title, The Sacred Book of You, Unveiling the Lost Teachings of the Deep Feminine. How does one reach you, Ruth, to expand on this interview here and possibly take a workshop or a one-on-one session or, get your book?
Okay, I have a website, and it's www.ruthgouldgoodman.com. That's RUTHGOULDGOODMAN.com. I can take orders for the book from there. And I also am on Amazon. I also have a Kindle. I am teaching a series of workshops which are listed on my website that they can come to. And this Saturday I'm teaching a three-hour workshop which would be an introduction to this entry into the body. And anybody can do this. It is both the simplest and the hardest thing you'll ever do.
I kind of get that, you know. It's just like now I understand the term rewire. You know, the more I've listened, you know, it's starting to sort of sink in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, good. I'm glad of that. And I also do private sessions. I do body work. Very, very love. I'm an acupuncturist. I work with energies in the body. I've really learned how to communicate deeply with the energetic field and to hold space for the transformation of energies in the body. And I also do these sessions that have to do with working with the trauma stories that are hindering our evolution and helping them to reintegrate and helping us to understand how to transform those stories and spin the energy into an opening.
Well, and also you mentioned the workshops. You're located in Venice,
yes,
California.
Am.
So
number. Okay.
Okay.
The phone number 310-392-3612.
Well, Ruth, I appreciate you being on the show, and maybe at some point I'll take a session with you and I'll have you come back on and we'll talk about it.
That would be fabulous. First of all, I want to say it has been a great pleasure to talk with you. This material is not easy to talk about. I don't think there is even language for it. And I am working on creating a way of talking about it so that it can be spoken of. But it's not easy. And I appreciate so much your following me, your being with me, and asking such great questions. And I would love to share this work with you anytime, Karen.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ruth. I really get the, I think there's really something here that we all need to learn. And you know, I think this is really important. And as someone who always has to fight getting out of my head and learning to be in the body, you know, this is something I think I would at some point like to do with you. So,
yay.
Okay. Well, and you're in Venice. I mean, how can I not, right? You're practically my neighbor. Who'd have thought?
Well, you know, what I really love the contexting of this knowledge that you do, the storytelling, the goddess telling of all of this. And I really do think that, you know, there's something that I've been tracking that is like the first stitch. You know, it's the first stitch. It's like somehow it's something happens in that first stitch that everything else all of a sudden makes sense.
Well, you know, I think we all have little pieces of the puzzle, and when we get together and we all compare notes, I think we're going to have a beautiful tapestry.
I agree with you. So it's been joyful to me to talk with you, and I hope that I've been able to transmit this literally body of understanding that I am, so that it can be understood.
Well, I think you are. There's probably listeners out there more sophisticated than I that maybe were able to catch it better, and I hope that's the case. But you know, like I said, the more I listened, the more I started to get it, and I certainly can imagine. You know, being with you, you know, doing the breath, you know, doing the exercises you talked about, you know, in a, you know, for an hour or a couple hours, you know, under your tent, you know, I think it would all just start to click, you know, in a real meaningful way that's a little difficult to do right here in this moment.
Well, absolutely.
So keep this up. Keep up trying to figure out the language, you know, because the language, it you know, this is new stuff, so it's you know, we have to figure out how to grasp it.
Right, and part of my joy in this opportunity is the challenge of telling, and I know that there's I understand it. It's my job to find the words and create the words and create the ability to. And your questioning also is very helpful, you know, where it is that your understanding or not understanding helps direct me to.
I understand that. Well, Ruth, thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll figure out a way to, you know, come back and do this, and maybe people can benefit from my experience of working with you, and that might make a fun show.
I would love it. So listen, one more time, I'm doing this workshop. It's right here in Venice, and the phone number. I want to invite people to partake. This knowledge is living in me, and I am very good at transmitting it through physicality.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing. And what's the phone number again?
310-392-3612.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ruth, and you have a good night, and I am sure we'll talk soon. I mean, we're neighbors.
I know. And blessings to the amazing work you do and what you're bringing forward. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you too, Ruth. We're all part of this, so, you know, we're all just doing what we're called to do. So we'll eventually get there. All right. Well, good night.
So it is. Bye. Good night.
Good night. Well, listeners, that was Ruth Gould Goodman, and I invite you to look more into her work. And if you want to get in touch with her and you didn't get a chance to write down her contact information, you can always email me, and I'm happy to put you in touch, and maybe we will come back on the show and after doing a session with her, you know, we can talk about it. Just a couple quick reminders, some announcements for you, because the show is about only got 3 minutes left. I wanted to say, if you're in the Irvine area on Sunday, September 12th, I will be priestessing at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. I'll be leading the Sunday service from 11 to 12:30. That's Sunday, September 12th, so I'd love to meet you. Also, November 13th, I am part of the Gaia Festival in Santa Barbara. I'm going to be giving a presentation on the Saturday of that weekend festival, Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. And in November of next year, 2011, we have on the calendar a sacred tour of goddess sites of Turkey, which I am going to lead. Details will follow. Keep in touch with me. Keep checking my website. Information will be up there pretty soon. And we'll post everything we know is just as soon as we have it on a link that I can give you to see all the details. And the tour will be for men and women. So, as tonight comes to a close, I'd like to just invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath and bring an even deeper focus to this gentle, simple little prayer that someone sent me on Facebook that I really love. Brings back memories. Now I lay me down to sleep. Please help me learn my world to keep, to guard the air and skies of blue, the oceans, lakes, and rivers too. Save the mighty forest lands, the plains, the shores, the desert sands. Protect all creatures, wild and free, in air, on land, and in the sea. So imagine if that was the prayer we taught our sons and daughters before they closed their eyes at night. Well, listeners, thank you for coming to the show this week. I hope you'll come back next week, and I appreciate you spending your time with me. So let me close by saying, may we all find our voice and use it in whatever way we can. Let us be her roar. Good night, listeners. That's it.